Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 5. The Dark Woman. Ashenden and General Carmona went through the formalities at the frontier independently, and when they returned to their carriage, Ashenden handed back to his companion the revolver and the knife. He sighed. "Now I feel more comfortable. What do you say to a game of cards?"
"I should like it," said Ashenden.
The hairless Mexican opened his bag again and from a corner extracted a greasy pack of French cards. He asked Ashenden whether he played écarté, and when Ashenden told him that he did not, suggested piqué. This was a game that Ashenden was not unfamiliar with, so they settled the stakes and began. Since both were in favor of quick action, they played the game of four hands, doubling the first and last. Ashenden had good enough cards, but the general seemed, notwithstanding, always to have better. Ashenden kept his eyes open, and he was not careless of the possibility that his antagonist might correct the inequalities of chance, but he saw nothing to suggest that everything was not above board. He lost game after game. He was capoted and rubiconed. The score against him mounted up and up till he had lost something like 1,000 francs, which at the time was a tidy sum. The general smoked innumerable cigarettes. He made them himself with a twist of the finger, a lick of his tongue, and incredible celerity. At last he flung himself against the back of his seat. "By the way, my friend, does the British government pay your card losses when you're on a mission?" he asked.
"It certainly does not."
"Well, I think you've lost enough. If it went down on your expense account, I would have proposed playing till we reached Rome, but you're sympathetic to me. If it's your own money, I don't want to win any more of it." He picked up the cards and put them aside. Ashenden, somewhat ruefully, took out a number of notes and handed them to the Mexican. He counted them, and with his usual neatness, put them carefully folded into his pocketbook. Then, leaning forward, he patted Ashenden almost affectionately on the knee. "I like you. You are modest and unassuming. You have not the arrogance of your countrymen, and I am sure that you'll take my advice in the spirit in which it is meant. Do not play piquet with people you don't know." Ashenden was somewhat mortified, and perhaps his face showed it, for the Mexican seized his hand. "My dear fellow, I have not hurt your feelings. I would not do that for the world. You do not play piquet worse than most piquet players. It's not that. If we were going to be together longer, I would teach you how to win at cards. One plays cards to win money, and there's no sense in losing." "I thought it was only in love and war that all things were fair," said Ashenden, with a chuckle. "Ah, I'm glad to see you smile. That's the way to take a loss. I see that you have good humor and good sense. You will go far in life. When I get back to Mexico and in possession of my estates again, you must come and stay with me. I will treat you like a king. You shall ride my best horses. We will go together to bullfights. And if there are girls you fancy, you have only to say the word, and you shall have them." He began telling Ashenden of the vast territories, the haciendas and the mines in Mexico of which he had been dispossessed. He told him of the feudal state in which he lived. It didn't matter whether what he said was true or not, for those sonorous phrases of his were fruity with the rich distilled perfumes of romance. He described a spacious life that seemed to belong to another age, and his eloquent gestures brought before the mind's eye tawny distances and vast green plantations, great herds of cattle, and in the moonlit night the song of the blind singers that melted in the air and the twanging of guitars. "Everything I lost, everything! In Paris, I was driven to earn a pittance by giving Spanish lessons or showing Americanos del Norte, I mean, the night life of the city. I, who have flung away 1,000 duros on a dinner, have been forced to beg my bread like a blind Indian. I, who have taken pleasure in clasping a diamond bracelet round the wrist of a beautiful woman, have been forced to accept a suit of clothes from a hag old enough to be my mother. Patience. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward, but misfortune cannot last forever. The time is ripe, and soon we shall strike our blow."
He took up the greasy pack of cards and set them out in a number of little piles.
Let us see what the cards say. They never lie.
Ah, if I had only had the greater faith in them, I should have avoided the action of my life that has weighed heavily on me. My conscience is at ease. I did what any man would do under the circumstances, but I regret that necessity forced upon me an action that I would willingly have avoided.
He looked through the cards, set some of them on one side on a system Ashenden didn't understand, shuffled the remainder, and once more put them in little piles.
The cards warned me. I'll never deny that. Their warning was dear and definite. Love and a dark woman, danger, betrayal, and death. It was as plain as the nose on your face. Any fool would have known what it meant, and I've been using the cards all my life. I was besotted.
Ah, you of the northern races don't know what love means. You don't know how it can prevent you from sleeping, how it can take your appetite for food away so that you dwindle as if from a fever. You do not understand what a frenzy it is, so that you are like a madman, and you will stick at nothing to satisfy your desire. A man like me is capable of every folly and every crime when he's in love. Si, signor, and of heroism. He can scale mountains higher than Everest and swim seas broader than the Atlantic. He is God. He is devil. Women have been my ruin.
Once more, the hairless Mexican glanced at the cards, took some out of the little piles, and left others in. He shuffled them again.
I have been loved by multitudes of women. I do not say it in vanity. I offer no explanation. It's mere matter of fact. Go to Mexico City and ask them what they know of Manuel Carmona and of his triumphs. Ask them how many women have resisted Manuel Carmona.
Ashenden, frowning a little, watched him reflectively. He wondered whether R., that shrewd fellow who chose his instruments with such a sure instinct, had not this time made a mistake, and he was uneasy. Did the hairless Mexican really believe that he was irresistible, or was he merely a blatant liar? In the course of his manipulations, he'd thrown out all the cards in the pack but four, and these now lay in front of him, face downwards and side by side. He touched them one by one, but didn't turn them up.
There is fate, he said, and no power on earth can change it. I hesitate. This is a moment that ever fills me with apprehension, and I have to steel myself to turn over the cards that may tell me that disaster awaits me. I'm a brave man, but sometimes I've reached this stage and not had the courage to look at the four vital cards. Indeed, now he eyed the backs of them with an anxiety he didn't try to hide.
What was I saying to you?
You were telling me that women found your fascinations irresistible, replied Ashenden dryly.
Once, all the same, I found a woman who resisted me. I saw her first in a house, a casa de mujeres, in Mexico City. She was going down the stairs as I went up. She was not very beautiful. I had had 100 more beautiful. But she had something that took my fancy, and I told the old woman who kept the house to send her to me. You will know her when you go to Mexico City. They call her La Marquesa. She said that the girl was not an inmate, but came there only from time to time and had left. I told her to have her there next evening and not to let her go till I came. But I was delayed, and when I arrived, La Marquesa told me that the girl had said she was not used to being kept waiting and had gone. I'm a good-natured fellow, and I don't mind if women are capricious and teasing. That's part of their charm. So with a laugh, I sent her a note of 100 duros, and promised that on the following day I would be punctual. But when I went, on the minute, La Marquesa handed me back my 100 duros and told me the girl did not fancy me. I laughed at her impertinence. I took off the diamond ring I was wearing and told the old woman to give her that and see whether it would induce her to change her mind. In the morning, La Marquesa brought me in return for my ring a red carnation. I did not know whether to be amused or angry. I'm not used to being thwarted in my passions. I never hesitate to spend money. What is it for but to squander on pretty women? And I told La Marquesa to go to the girl and say that I would give her 1,000 duros to dine with me that night. Presently she came back with the answer that the girl would come on the condition that I allowed her to go home immediately after dinner. I accepted, with a shrug of the shoulders. I did not think she was serious. I thought she was saying that only to make herself more desired. She came to dinner at my house. Did I say she was not beautiful? She was the most beautiful, the most exquisite creature I had ever met. I was intoxicated. She had charm and she had wit. She had all the gracia of the Andalusian. In one word, she was adorable. I asked her why she had treated me so casually, and she laughed in my face. I laid myself out to be agreeable. I exercised all my skill. I surpassed myself. But when we finished dinner, she rose from her seat and bade me good night. I asked her where she was going. She said I had promised to let her go, and she trusted me as a man of honor to keep my word. I expostulated. I reasoned. I raved. I stormed. She held me to my word. All I could induce her to do was to consent to dine with me the following night on the same terms. You'll think I was a fool. I was the happiest man alive. For 7 days I paid her 1,000 silver duros to dine with me. Every evening I waited for her with my heart in my mouth, as nervous as a novillero at his first bullfight. And every evening she played with me, laughed at me, coquetted with me, and drove me frantic. I was madly in love with her. I have never loved anyone so much before or since. I could think of nothing else. I was distracted. I neglected everything. I am a patriot, and I love my country. A small band of us had got together and made up our minds that we could no longer put up with the misrule from which we were suffering. All the lucrative posts were given to other people. We were being made to pay taxes as though we were tradesmen, and we were exposed to abominable affronts. We had money and men. Our plans were made, and we were ready to strike. I had an infinity of things to do, meetings to go to, ammunition to get, orders to give. I was so besotted over this woman that I could attend to nothing. You would have thought that I should be angry with her for making such a fool of me. Me, who had never known what it was not to gratify my smallest whim. I did not believe that she refused me to inflame my desires. I believed that she told the plain truth when she said that she would not give herself to me until she loved me. She said it was for me to make her love me. I thought her an angel. I was ready to wait. My passion was so consuming that sooner or later, I felt at last it must communicate itself to her. It was like a fire on the prairie that devours everything around it. And at last, she said she loved me. My emotion was so terrific that I thought I should fall down and die. Oh, what rapture! Oh, what madness! I could have given her everything I possessed in the world. I would have torn down the stars from heaven to deck her hair. I wanted to do something to prove to her the extravagance of my love. I wanted to do the impossible, the incredible. I wanted to give her myself, my soul, my honor, all I had and all I was. And that night, when she lay in my arms, I told her of our plot and who we were that were concerned in it. I felt her body stiffen with attention. I was conscious of a flicker of her eyelids. There was something. I hardly knew what. The hand that stroked my face was dry and cold. A sudden suspicion seized me, and all at once I remembered what the cards had told me. Love and a dark woman. Danger, betrayal, and death. 3 times they'd said it, and I wouldn't heed. I made no sign that I had noticed anything. She nestled up against my heart and told me that she was frightened to hear such things, and asked me if so-and-so was concerned. I answered her. I wanted to make sure. One after the other, with infinite cunning, between her kisses, she cajoled me into giving every detail of the plot. And now I was certain as I am that you sit before me, that she was a spy. She was a spy of the president's, and she had been sent to allure me with her devilish charm, and now she had wormed out of me all our secrets. The lives of all of us were in her hands, and I knew that if she left that room in 24 hours, we would be dead men. And I loved her. I loved her. Oh, words cannot tell you the agony of desire that burned my heart. Love like that is no pleasure. It is pain. Pain. But the exquisite pain that transcends all pleasure. It is that heavenly anguish that the saints speak of when they're seized with a divine ecstasy. I knew that she must not leave the room alive, and I feared that if I delayed, my courage would fail me. "I think I shall sleep," she said. "Sleep, my dove," I answered. "Alma de mi corazón," she called me. "Soul of my heart." They were the last words she spoke. Those heavy lids of hers, dark like a grape and faintly humid, those heavy lids of hers closed over her eyes, and a little while I knew by the regular movement of her breast against mine that she slept. You see, I loved her. I could not bear that she should suffer. She was a spy, yes, but my heart bade me spare her the terror of knowing what must happen. It's strange. I felt no anger because she'd betrayed me. I should have hated her because of her vileness. I could not. I only felt that my soul was enveloped in night. Poor thing. Poor thing. I could have cried for pity for her. I drew my arm very gently from around her. My left arm, that was. My right arm was free. And raised myself on my hand. But she was so beautiful. I turned my face away when I drew the knife with all my strength across her lovely throat. Without awaking, she passed from sleep to death. He stopped and stared, frowning, at the four cards that still lay, their backs upward, waiting to be turned up. It was in the cards. Why did I not take their warning? I'll not look at them. Damn them. Take them away. With a violent gesture, he swept the whole pack onto the floor. Though I'm a free thinker, I had masses said for her soul. He leaned back and rolled himself a cigarette. He inhaled a long breathful of smoke. He shrugged his shoulders. The colonel said you were a writer. What do you write?
Stories, replied Ashenden.
Detective stories?
No.
Why not?
They are the only ones I read. If I were a writer, I should write detective stories.
They are very difficult. You need an incredible amount of invention. I devised a murder story once, but the murder was so ingenious that I could never find a way of bringing it home to the murderer. And after all, one of the conventions of the detective story is that the mystery should in the end be solved and the criminal brought to justice. If your murder is as ingenious as you think, the only means you have of proving the murderer's guilt is by the discovery of his motives. When once you've found a motive, the chances are that you'll hit upon evidence that until then had escaped you. If there's no motive, the most damning evidence will be inconclusive. Imagine, for instance, that you went up to a man in a lonely street on a moonless night and stabbed him to the heart. Who would ever think of you? But if he was your wife's lover, or your brother, or had cheated or insulted you, then a scrap of paper, a bit of string, or a chance remark would be enough to hang you. What were your movements at the time he was killed? Are there not a dozen people who saw you before and after? But if he was a total stranger, you would never for a moment be suspected. It was inevitable that Jack the Ripper should escape unless he was caught in the act. Ashenden had more than one reason to change the conversation. They were parting at Rome, and he thought it necessary to come to an understanding with his companion about their respective movements. The Mexican was going to Brindisi, and Ashenden to Naples. He meant to lodge at the Hotel de Belfast, which was a large second-rate hotel near the harbor, frequented by commercial travelers and the thriftier kind of tripper. It would be as well to let the general have the number of his room so that he could come up if necessary without inquiring of the porter, and at the next stopping place Ashenden got an envelope from the station buffet and made him address it in his own writing to himself at the post office in Brindisi. All Ashenden had to do then was to scribble a number on a sheet of paper and post it. The hairless Mexican shrugged his shoulders. To my mind, all these precautions are rather childish. There's absolutely no risk, but whatever happens, you may be quite sure that I will not compromise you. This is not the sort of job I'm very familiar with, said Ashenden. I'm content to follow the colonel's instructions and know no more about it than it's essential I should.
Quite so. Should the exigencies of the situation force me to take a drastic step, and I get into trouble, I shall, of course, be treated as a political prisoner. Sooner or later, Italy is bound to come into the war on the side of the Allies, and I shall be released. I have considered everything, but I beg you, very seriously, to have no more anxiety about the outcome of our mission than if you were going for a picnic on the Thames. But when at last they separated, and Ashenden found himself alone in a carriage on the way to Naples, he heaved a great sigh of relief. He was glad to be rid of that chattering, hideous, and fantastic creature. He was gone to meet Constantine Andreotti at Brindisi, and if half of what he had told Ashenden was true, Ashenden could not but congratulate himself that he did not stand in the Greek spy's shoes. He wondered what sort of a man he was. There was a grimness in the notion of his coming across the Blue Ionian, with his confidential papers and his dangerous secrets, all unconscious of the noose into which he was putting his head. Well, that was war, and only fools thought it could be waged with kid gloves on.